Rugby KO, a podcast that pulls no punches. We deliver rugby insights from passionate enthusiasts from the grassroots to the global game. Players, punters, professionals and partners providing uncensored opinions on how the sport of rugby can thrive again. Welcome to Rugby KO with your host, Katrina Oxenham.
Kerry Chikorovsky is a former New South Wales Liberal leader and the first woman to lead a major political party in New South Wales. She is also the founder and director of Chikorovsky & Associates, a government relations, community engagement and stakeholder relations consultancy, which she founded in 2003. Whose expertise spans a wide range of industries, including financial, government, community, property, and technology startups. Knowing the ins and outs of working with government and its departments has seen her assist a wide range of clients achieve success in circumstances where bureaucracy has been challenging to navigate. Removing these roadblocks via sound policy and strategic approach is what Kerry is widely known for in the industry. Kerry holds a number of non-executive board roles, including New South Wales Waratahs Rugby Union, Our Watch, Adopt Change, and the Humpty Dumpty Foundation. She is the chair of New South Wales Women's Rugby Union, an ambassador for the Australian Indigenous Education Foundation, and a mentor with the Minerva Network, supporting professional sportswomen on and off the field. Kerry can be seen and heard regularly as a media commentator across national television and radio channels, including Sky News, ABC Weekend Broadcast, ABC Weekend Breakfast, 2GB Radio, ABC The Drum, Channel 7 Sunrise, and was part of the key panel for the 7 News New South Wales 2019 state election coverage. Kerry and I chat about her political highs and lows, her involvement in rugby union, and in particular the women's game. We also discuss the Chikorovsky Cup, the broadcasting of rugby and how to continue to grow the women's game. There is some explicit language from time to time, as this is a raw interview full of passion about politics and, of course, rugby. Kerry, welcome today to the Rugby KO podcast and thank you for your time.
My pleasure to be here.
Kerry, in 1999 and until 2002, you were elected as the leader of the opposition in New South Wales, first ever female elected to the role. Can you firstly give us a background as to your various portfolios as both minister and shadow minister during that time and before that time, leading up to your appointment and election as the leader of the opposition?
So I was elected to Parliament in 1991, and that was unexpected for many because I was pre-selected after the election date had been called. Nick Greiner had called the election on the Friday, the previous member, John Dowd, had resigned on the Tuesday, and there was no candidate in the second safest seat in New South Wales for the Liberal Party. So we had a pre-selection on Sunday night in the car park of the Liberal Party headquarters, because that was the only room that was available for doing such a thing. And no one expected me to win. I was up against a sitting member, in fact, a sitting minister who was in the upper house who wanted to come down, and people thought it would just be a foregone conclusion that John Hannaford, who was actually a mate of mine, lovely man, minister, would win. But to everybody's surprise, I won that pre-selection and was thrown in the deep end into campaigning, which I loved. I just love campaigning. It's the best part of being a politician, to my mind, is, you know, getting out and meeting people. So we won that election just, and 12 months later, there was a problem with Nick Greiner and ICAC, and he resigned, and John Fay became Premier and appointed me into the Cabinet. And so my first role in the Cabinet was Minister for Consumer Affairs and Assistant Minister for Education. So I worked with Virginia Chadwick, which was an extraordinary learning experience. She was a wonderful, wonderful lady. And then 12 months after that, I became Minister for Industrial Relations, which was the first time there'd been an IR minister, female IR minister in the country. So that was a nice little first. And I was also Minister for Women. So that was pretty exciting because that was the first standalone ministry also in the country. And that was a reflection on how seriously John Fay took the issues relating to women and women's opportunity and advancement and, you know, position within the community. Mm-hmm. So that was all terrific. And then we lost the election. Oh, actually, no, I got elected deputy leader in that time as well. And then we lost the election. And Peter Collins became leader. And I decided to take 12 months out of the shadow cabinet, mainly because, to be honest, I'd been having trouble in my marriage and I thought I needed to take 12 months off to try and work out whether Chris and I would continue as a married couple. The answer was at the end of 12 months we decided to separate anyway, so I decided to go back into the shadow cabinet. So I went back in with one of the best portfolios I think I ever had. I was shadow minister for corrective services, which scared the bejesus out of my mother, because every time I went into a jail, she was quite convinced I was never going to come out. She'd read too many stories of, you know, women being held hostage in jail and people, you know, holding guns and threatening, needing helicopters, all those terrible things you see in the movie, none of which ever happened, of course. But it was an amazing, it was a really eye-opening experience being in jails and meeting some of the people who were in them. So I enjoyed that. And then I ended up shadow minister for the environment, which was also a huge learning curve. And eventually leader of the opposition. So, and after I lost that role, I was shadow minister for infrastructure, which is a huge portfolio, and particularly nowadays, it's even more important, the infrastructure portfolio. So I had a bit of a broad range of experience across the parliament, but thoroughly enjoyed all of it.
Yeah, wonderful. So there are some recent events in the National Parliament around women, and do you think a career in politics is a safe and fulfilling career nowadays for women, or what more can be done?
Look, I think it's been challenging for women. Well, when I was there, it was challenging for different reasons, perhaps. I mean, when I was there, there weren't a lot of other women in my position. I always say that the worst thing I did as the leader of the opposition was not admit that I was struggling. And there were times where I was struggling, and it was clearly, you know, it wasn't just the polls, it was rumblings within the Liberal Party, it was some treachery, people doing things which they shouldn't have been doing. Yeah. But I never actually admitted that to anyone. I would hope that that would be different nowadays, because there are people like me around who senior women can go talk to if they need to, and I do occasionally pick up the phone and talk to senior women. In fact, I've spoken to them on both sides. Because I think it's important that people like me, who have no agenda now, I have no political agenda beyond identifying people who I think are talented on both sides of the house and encouraging them and providing that ear that you know, they can yabber away to me, knowing that it's completely confidential and that I make no judgment. It's all about trying to help. So I think from that perspective, that's probably a little easier, because there are people that people there can talk to. The worst part about now, though, and it's not just for women, it's for everyone, is that it was always 24/7, but there was an opportunity to be a little bit more discreet. Nowadays, there's no discreet. You can't be discreet anywhere, because everybody has a camera, because everybody's got a phone. Everybody's a reporter, because everybody can tweet. And I think for everybody in Parliament now, that's really making it incredibly difficult. You know, you should be able to go out and feel safe, but you know, go out and have a glass of wine and someone says, oh, you know, saw so-and-so getting pissed at the pub the other day. Well, that's not necessarily true, but because they have a photo with it, you know, take a photo with a glass of wine in a hand, then that's how you can interpret it. So I think for everyone, I think social media in particular has made it very difficult. Having said that, I still think it's the best job you can do. It is, from my perspective, it was the most fulfilling thing I've ever done in my life. I enjoy what I do now, but it was the most fulfilling thing. Because I became a politician because I wanted to do things for people. And that's what politics allows you to do things for people, whether it's as a local member, you know, helping the people who we got into Department of Housing apartments who'd been on lists for too long, you know, whether it was helping, you know, people get traffic lights at the end of their road because they'd never been able to do them, just small things like that, which mean not a lot to a whole lot of people, but to the people who were affected, it was enormous. And then the higher up the food chain you go, the more you can do. You know, there are things you can do in terms of policy which really affect people's lives. And I think the most obvious example of that at the moment, of course, is the way the politicians of both, you know, persuasions, Labor and Liberal, have managed the COVID crisis. And I think we should be actually praising our politicians rather than, you know, saying, well, they stuffed up here and stuffed up there. Overwhelmingly, they've done an enormously good job for the community. Absolutely. And that's the perfect example of actually working extremely hard for the community.
Right. And so I believe it was in 2003, after narrowly losing the leadership by one vote, you retired. Do you think you had done all you wanted to do and achieve in politics? Were you happy to step away?
Well, I hadn't achieved everything I wanted to achieve because I had desperately wanted to be Premier.
Yeah.
That was my ultimate aim, was to be Premier. But was I happy to step away? I was, because it was a very deliberate decision on my part. I'd actually lost the leadership in 2002. My children wanted me to walk out then and there. Mm. And I went, no, I won't do that to the Liberal Party. I don't believe in by-elections. So I had another 12 months in the Parliament. And it was only at the end of 2002, over the Christmas period, and we were going into an election in 2003, it became quite clear that there were people within the Liberal Party who wanted me to leave. They were leaking stuff that I'd apparently said, which was just untrue. And then they were leaking that I'd made up my mind to go, which wasn't true, because I had actually made up my mind to stay. Anyway, it was quite a drawn-out process. And I went away in January, and I literally sat on a balcony overlooking a beach for a week. And I sat down and I worked. I wrote lists. Why would I stay? Why would I leave?
Mm.
And in the end, there were more reasons to leave. One, because my kids were desperately over it. The problem with being Chikorovsky is that, you know, you couldn't hide. I mean, my kids were 7 and 5 when I became a politician. So people used to say, oh, you know, what's it like having a mother as a politician? To which they would respond, what's it like not to? You know, because that's all they could remember was me being a poly. And they were pretty over it. So that was a big driver to leave. But also, I thought, if I leave now, because I was early 50s, it gives me an opportunity to do, you know, put the same drive and passion into what I did in politics to something else. So in the end, there were more reasons to leave than to stay. So I left. So I left happily. If I'd gone after the leadership loss, I would have been miserable for the rest of my life. Because that would have been a too big a decision to make in a very distraught time. So I needed to be calm and cool and rational about it, which is what I was in the end. And couple of nice glasses of rosé overlooking a beach, and I was persuaded I should leave.
Perfect. That sounds like a good decision-making process. So tell me about the book that was published called Chika. Yes. Any sort of anecdotes or stories from the book that, you know, what led to the publishing of that book?
So the book, I was asked by a publisher, because I was the first female to write a book, and I was hesitant to do it. And in the end, I decided it would probably be cathartic. So it was. I actually was able to put down on paper, you know, the reasons why I did it, the challenges I faced, the things I achieved, and, you know, the whole process of being the first female leader. So it was cathartic in that respect. I actually co-wrote it with my former chief of staff, a guy named Luis Garcia, who tempered some of my more aggressive writing, where he said to me, well, you really can't say that because you're going to regret that you put that in print. The funniest story in it, though, is when I lost the leadership, what happened was I had, not affectionately, but called the Gang of Five, came in to see me, and they had spoken to me. One of them had spoken to me on the Sunday night and told me what a great job I'd done. We'd had this, you know, fabulous state convention, and we got the front page of the Sunday Telegraph with a really great story, and he rang me on Sunday night and told me, you know, how fabulous I was, blah, blah, blah. Unbeknownst to me, he'd been meeting with four others on the Sunday afternoon, plotting my demise. Anyway, they walked into the office on the Monday and told me I had to leave. And they gave me three reasons. And the first reason was that we weren't doing well enough in the polls, which was completely untrue, because we'd actually, at that stage, were either neck and neck or just ahead of the Labor Party. So that wasn't true. They told me that the corporate world wasn't providing enough funding and support. Well, that was untrue, and they didn't know what that the funding was, because the only person who knew was me and the then state director, because we had discussions about fundraising. So I knew what was coming in the door. They were just guessing.
Mm.
But the third reason they gave me was that I was going to be incredibly embarrassed when I lost. So the funny part about the anecdote is that I wrote in the book, I said in the book, get the hell out of my office. Well, that's actually not true. But I knew my mother would read the book, and my mother was really dead set against swearing. So what I actually said was, fuck off now, get out of my office and don't fucking ever talk to me again. Right? So that's what I said, but that's not what I put in the book. And so when I wrote it, Lewis...
Protecting your mother.
Well, when I wrote it, Lewis and I said to Lewis, because Lewis was there when I said it, because he was with me, he went, Lewis loved my mother. He said, I don't think Jill would like to read that you swore. So I put it very politely, get the hell out of my office. So, yeah.
Yeah, but, true politics at work, it sounds like.
Well, you know. Mm. Couldn't ruin my mother's opinion of me.
And so, Kerry, can we talk a little bit now about rugby? So you also hold various directorships in relation to rugby, and I just wanted to chat further about those. So you're a director of the New South Wales Rugby Union / Waratahs Rugby Union Board, and you're also chair of the New South Wales Women's Rugby. So what can the boards and those boards do to influence or improve or, provide governance and strategy around rugby, both women's game, obviously, and also rugby in New South Wales?
Well, I unashamedly have been a huge advocate for the women's game. Mm. The reason I got involved in rugby in the administration side was because Nick Farr-Jones asked me some years ago when it became, when it was announced that rugby was going to be part of the Olympics. Mm. And people don't understand, the only reason rugby was included in the Olympics was because it was played by men and women. The International Olympic Committee had made the decision that they wouldn't put in any more sports which were only played by one sex. Mm. So it was the girls who actually, and I keep saying this to people, it's because of the girls that we're now in the Olympics, which is, pretty exciting. Mm. And of course they were the gold medalists. So he asked me to get involved to try and see what we could do about promoting women's rugby in New South Wales. So I started getting involved with that, and then from that I went on to the Community Rugby Board and then on to the Waratahs Board, and now I'm on the Combined Board. And my passion for the women has not abated in any way, but I'm a huge advocate for the boys as well. So we've obviously had a difficult year with the Waratahs this year. Mm. We've had to make some difficult decisions, and I know there are people who are critical of the fact that we changed coaches and got rid of one coach, and we're now in the process of finding a new one. But to their credit, the two assistant coaches have stepped up, and whilst we still haven't won, I absolutely see signs of improvement. I'm the only director who actually travels as much as I can with the team. Mm. And I always joke that it's really easy to be there when they're winning. It's much more difficult to be there when they're losing. But I've got great admiration for those young men. I sat and had dinner with them on Saturday night after the game in Auckland against the Blues. And, they don't have to talk to me. I mean, they can sit there and be morose and miserable But they are actually unfailingly polite. Always say hello to me. And I just think that that's a measure of their character, that instead of being miserable and surly, they could actually be, they're as gracious as they are towards me. And as I said, I'm just a board director. They don't really know who I am. But I think that's just because they're really good young men. And it is tough. It's really tough for them, to get up every week and with all the stuff that people write about them in the newspapers, the terrible record that people keep saying now they're going to be, the worst team we've ever had. But I just think we have to continue to encourage them. We are looking for a new coach at the moment, which will be in place so that we can have a strong development over the break so that the team can be as best they can. But we just need to continue to support them and, I think, encourage them, because they're young men carrying a very large burden. Mm. And we shouldn't expect them to carry it alone. The board has to accept responsibility for the decisions that have been made around coach selection, about player selection, about a lot of those things. And I'm not entirely convinced that we've done that as publicly as we should have. But I do think that people are now aware that the process going forward, for example, to select the new coach, we are all to be engaged in that, and it's to be very transparent. And then we will all have to accept responsibility for those decisions very publicly.
Mm. And so historically, the New South Wales Rugby Union Board and the Waratahs Rugby Union Board were two separate entities, and now they are combined. Does the board look after everything in New South Wales rugby, or is it more the professional arm of the Waratahs that the board has responsibility for?
No, there was a decision made a few years ago to combine the boards, to bring them back into one, and that's very logical. Mm. And I was a very, very strong advocate for that, because the reality is without a strong community game, you are not going to have a strong professional game. We need to have young men and women, boys and girls, of all shapes and sizes, playing rugby, loving rugby, being committed to rugby, both as players and, you know, as they grow older as fans. And unless you've got that engagement with the community, then you're going to struggle to have the support from that community to the professional game. So we brought the boards back together again, so we oversee both. Certainly there are different skills required for both, but mm-hmm. we've got very good people in, you know, kind of leadership roles in both the corporate part of the organisation and in the community part, so I'm confident about that. And it's, you know, we're actually holding our own against some of the other sports, but we've had massive participation increase in girls and women. So I think we went from something like 3 or 5% of participation numbers till nearly 20% now. So we're very excited about the growth of the women's game and girls' game. But I don't understand how you can have one without the other.
Mm. And so when I believe you originally were on the board, I think you were the only female on that board. Is there better representation now?
So I was the only female on the community board, and then I went on to the Waratah board in two, Saturday night and nine. We've now got two again on the combined board, Katrina Rathi and myself. Slowly, but you know, it's getting there. I mean, I look at the Rugby Australia board, they've now got three women. They've kind of gone up and down, but they're now back to three women. So I think it's not as quick as I would like, but we're getting there.
Yeah. And so with the state bodies and the board in particular that you're involved with, is there an alignment of strategy and direction between the states and Rugby Australia?
I think it's fair to say that there's been a level of anxiety over a number of years about the relationships between the franchises and Rugby Australia. I don't think I'm saying anything that anybody would be surprised at. I think under Hamish McLennan's leadership, and hopefully under Andy, there is greater transparency, although we've still got some ways to go. But I think everyone's now realised that it is in the better interest of rugby in Australia that the franchises and Rugby Australia work more closely together. So decisions that about things like competition, for example, need to be made collectively and not be handed down from on high. We still have some examples where they haven't quite got that. To be honest, I was very disappointed with their decision to change the Super W format this year. I just thought that they're basically playing it across a week in Coffs Harbour, which means that the girls will get little or no television coverage. And at a time when we're all so very excited about the Stan deal, and the Stan people have promised more coverage of the women's game, I just think it's an opportunity lost to have them up in Coffs Harbour. I also think, and I'll probably get into trouble for saying this, I also think it's not a health and safety issue that they're playing so many games in such a short period of time. But, I lost that battle, let me tell you.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. But that was my next question, actually. I was going to ask you around the calendar for the girls, because I know it's been disrupted, you know, due to COVID, et cetera. There was a lot of plans for the Wallaroos, but also for the state team. So what is the calendar looking like? Is it just Coffs Harbour competition at this stage till the end of the year?
Well, that's for the Super W girls.
Yeah.
The Wallaroos are supposed to be playing, I think it's Samoa, in at the end of the year. It's either Samoa or the Solomon Islands. I think it's Samoa. I'm pretty sure it's Samoa. They're playing, and that will be their only internationals before the Rugby World Cup next year. They were supposed to have a calendar which included New Zealand, in New Zealand and here, but because of COVID that all got disrupted. And as far as I'm aware, they haven't been reinstated. In fact, I would like to go and have a conversation with Rugby Australia, because now having just come back from New Zealand and having experienced the bubble, the girls should be able to go now. So you prompt me to actually go and have a conversation with them about what we can do for the girls.
Yeah.
And do you feel that it is an area that's been identified by Rugby Australia as a growth area of the game, and you've just mentioned the marked increase in participation of the women's game. Are there the resources to support that? I mean, it's great that a company like Stan is going to broadcast a bit more, you know, a lot more of the games, but do the girls have the required resources to really grow it?
I think it's fair to say that they're getting more, but are they getting enough? Well, the answer, if you ask me, is never. They never get enough. I think it's still very difficult for the girls. I mean, for example, and I'll use the Coffs Harbour example, the girls have to take holidays. They have to take leave because they're not paid full time. The Super W girls. So they have to take leave to go and play in a competition like that. And I think that's tough on them.
Yeah,
it's tough on them. I'm not sure. I don't even know. I must go ask whether they're getting a per diem, which I can't imagine they will. If they do, it won't be much. But I mean, yeah, I just find that there's a lot of talk and there is a lot of support talked about. I have yet to see as much of it translated as I would like. And I spend a lot of time talking to people about what we can do. And so when they announced that the Cadbury deal included the Wallaroos, the Wallabies and the Wallaroos, I went, okay. But then one is principal partner, one is support. So I'm not quite sure what that means for the Wallaroos.
Right. Okay. That was a fine print because I noticed that as well. Mm. Yeah. So there are areas that we can grow the women's game. What are the areas that you've identified for both city and country regions where we can grow the women's game?
Well, clearly the greatest growth at the moment is in the sevens. And what I'd like to see is us to grow tens as well, because I think there are a lot of girls who will not be able to play sevens at higher levels because they're just not built for it. And it's as simple as that. So what we need to do, but we need to be able to encourage schoolgirls to transition from sevens to tens to 15s. So we don't have a very strong tens competition, but I'd like to see us put some more effort into that. I certainly want us to be able to transition older girls, you know, school leavers, into 15s. And that's why, for example, we have the Chigorowski Cup, because there wasn't enough opportunity for girls to be playing 15s in a structured competition. So I want more of that because, you know, rugby is a game all shapes and sizes. And, you know, for a lot of the girls, we've got a lot of girls whose brothers are playing rugby who want to play the game. But as I said, they're going to need to play 15. So we need to put time and energy and effort into both. But schoolgirls, for example, coming through sevens, that's going gangbusters.
Yeah, great.
And clubs now. We're actually, because all the clubs, we're encouraging clubs now to run sevens teams as well for the women.
The Chigorowski Cup in 2017, which is wonderful. It was launched as a competition for women's rugby. How is that progressing? Are there more teams in the competition, and what are the plans?
We had more this year. And I think that was because, to be honest, that was because Rugby Australia decided to put some money in this year, which was good. But, yeah, I'm hoping that it will grow because it is just an opportunity. It's a step up. It's a step up from club. It's not quite Super W. It's in between. And it gives girls an opportunity to show what they can do. And they play a very entertaining form of rugby, let me tell you, the girls. And I remember saying to Michael Checker on one occasion, Michael, you should go watch the girls play. And he goes, Checker, why would I watch the girls play? And I said, because they actually play running rugby, which is what Australians want to see. They don't kick the ball away as much. And I said, you know, you could go. And, you know, you can imagine Checker listening to me. Absolutely not. But anyway, I felt obliged to let him know he should watch the girls. But, yeah, they play a really entertaining form of rugby. And the more opportunities we give them, the better. So I have said to the people who organise it that, you know, if they need some support next year, I'll be happy to support it again and hopefully get more teams playing.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you for your involvement. But so the girls in Rio won, and it feels like perhaps we capitalised on that, perhaps we didn't.
We didn't, is my view.
Yeah. And so what do you think, you know, they do play a wonderful form of rugby. What can we do to get more crowds, more involvement, more corporate dollar?
Yeah. Well, and it's chicken and the egg. Because someone said this to me the other day. They said, well, you know, why don't the girls get sponsored more? And I said, because they're not on TV enough. Well, why not aren't they on TV enough? Because the powers that be don't think people will watch them. But once they do watch them, they want to watch them. So that's why I'm so excited about Stan, because I think Stan are being genuine in in their coverage and wanting to put women on TV more, which is terrific. So I'll keep my fingers crossed. Mm. But I think it is. It's just, you know, I mean, I remember when we started, we introduced women's sevens at halftime at the Waratahs games. And, you know, that's where everybody goes in and has their big boozy dinner and stuff.
Yeah.
And these blokes were standing outside watching. And I'll never forget the number of times they'd say to me, Chica, these girls can really play. And I said, yes, I kept telling you that the girls can really play. And they would actually stand out and watch them while they played their, you know, their two halves, and then go in and gobble down their dinner before the second half of the Waratahs. And I think that needs to be the, you know, the object of the game is to get more eyes on them, both on, you know, at game, but also on television. And the more people who see that they can play, it's a bit like women's AFL, women's cricket. Mm-hmm. Once you realise the level of professionalism, the level of skill, you know, the enjoyment that you get from watching those girls run around a paddock,
yeah,
that the other stuff will flow. But it's not happening as quickly as I would like, which is why I spend a lot of time talking about it and pushing people to sponsor and support them.
Yeah. And again, thank you for all of that energy, because I'm sure the girls, you know, really appreciate it too. And there is big inroads and it's exciting to see. Yeah. So what are your thoughts, just digressing slightly, on the 2027 bid for the Rugby World Cup to be hosted here?
I think we're a good chance to get the... If I was having money, I'd definitely have money on the Olympics.
Yeah.
And I'd probably have a pretty sizable bet on the Rugby World Cup. And that's for a couple of reasons. The interesting thing about Olympic bids, because I was involved in our bid for 2000.
Oh, were you?
Yeah. Because we were in government at the time. And that process was extraordinarily complicated, but also involved a huge amount of expenditure because, you know, we had to build all new stadia and all sorts of things like that. Well, now the Olympic Committee have woken up to themselves and you can repurpose. And so that, I think, is a, you know, significant reason why Brisbane could get it, because they've already got a lot of stadia. Yes, they'll have to do something to the Gabba, I'm told, but they've got a lot of stadia. So that's a big plus for them. And the same for the Rugby World Cup. We don't have to build a venue. You know, we need to have 10. We've got 10 across the country which all meet the standards for a Rugby World Cup. So I think that's pretty exciting. Big fan of Phil Kearns. So
yeah,
I think if anyone can pull it off, Phil can. And whilst I don't know Premier Palaszczuk, I know she's got a very good team behind her, including AOC President John Coates. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that we get both.
Yeah, wonderful. So you think it'll be a great injection of funds and focus on rugby and for the sport?
Totally.
Yeah.
You know, there was no doubt that the Rugby World Cup here created a whole lot of, well, again, let me put it this way. A whole lot of people went to those games who'd never been to a rugby game before. Because one of the things which people don't realise about Australians is even if they don't know the sport, even if they don't like the sport, they want to participate. So that's why we had sell out crowds at, you know, even the smaller venues, because everybody just wanted to go there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, USA versus Japan in on the Central Coast, sell out.
Yeah.
I digress. You heard the story about the T-shirt that they built?
No.
That they sold at that thing?
No.
It was the funniest thing ever. It was Pearl Harbor, Hiroshima, Central, Gosford, the decider. What a fantastic T-shirt. Only Australians would do something like that. Yeah. Anyway, so people get involved. My problem with what they did and I wasn't in a position to do anything about it at the time, was I don't think they capitalised on the enthusiasm. I think the Japanese have done a better job of capitalising on the enthusiasm in Japan after the Rugby World Cup, tempered, of course, by COVID, which made everything difficult. But I think we could have done a better job, and I would hope that if we do get it here, we'll do a much better job and get those people and have them as fans. It's the Jesuit thing, you know. You get them when they're young. I've got them for life.
Yeah.
I just want to get people to an event like that and then have them for the rest of their lives as fans.
Yeah, wonderful. And so I also noticed that you are an ambassador for the Australian Indigenous Education Foundation. What do you do? What's your involvement there?
With them.
Okay.
I'm there whenever they need me, to be honest. They asked me to do it a long time ago. So I'm a voice if they need me to be a voice. I attend functions when they need me to. But I did that because it was an opportunity, I think, for some of those young people, because it's not just me, there's a lot more people who are a lot more involved, to actually meet people like me who they can discuss opportunities with. But I don't do a huge amount with them, that's to be fair.
Yeah.
I do a lot more with all my other charities.
Yeah, and that was my next question. You're involved as a mentor in a Minerva network. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what do professional sportswomen need to attain the required support and mentorship?
The problem with a lot of the sports, and particularly for girls, but it's for everyone as well, but you know, you have this whole focus for a very short period of time, and then how do you capitalise that on moving forward beyond when your time is up? I spent a fair bit of time talking to rowers, because you know the time, energy, effort to get into a boat to get to the Olympics is enormous, and then when it's all over, you almost fall off a cliff because there's not a lot of support to help them. So I've got a very strong view that we should be doing as much as we can to not only mentor, but you know, provide opportunities, introduce young people, through Minerva, young women, to organisations which can use their talents and skills. As I keep explaining to people, if you're a professional sports person, that's an enormous level of commitment, energy, dedication, focus, everything that an employer would be looking for in pretty well any person they employed. So we just need to provide the right framework in which they can use those skills with the right people. And that's kind of what Minerva does.
Yeah, wonderful. And also employers perhaps looking outside the square at those skills that they are transferable. Yeah, yeah,
totally. Well, they are. I mean, I remember, you know, years ago, my cousin, in fact, she applied for her job, first job after being at home for 15 years. And they asked her what skills she had, and she said time management, organisation. And she went through all these things, and they said, oh, so where have you been working? She said, I've been looking after 4 children under the age of 10.
Yeah.
Anyway, they burst out laughing and gave her the job.
Oh, wonderful. Good for her. You know, it's getting that conversation right, isn't it?
Totally. And how you frame it.
So what's next for women's rugby?
Oh, well, hopefully continued growth. And as I said, you know, getting the opportunity to translate girls from schools to more senior competitions, that's a big push for me. Mm. I'd like to see more of that. So more opportunities for them to play. And there are Sydney comps, there are country comps. But trying to, and the last 12 months has been a disaster for everyone because you know, everyone just dropped out and nothing much was happening, although we did get competitions running later in the season. So the more I can do of that, the more I can encourage that, the more I can, from my personal perspective, persuade parents. And it's interesting, it's actually the fathers who are more reluctant, in my experience, to have their daughters play rugby than the mothers. And I love talking to the parents of the girls who do play, the Super W girls, the Australian girls. I love talking to those parents because they say, oh, you know, we wish they just would understand. And I said, well, I need you to be telling everyone that your daughter plays rugby and, you know, and she loves it and it's fantastic. And they go, yeah, but they go, you know, they have to tackle. And you go, yeah, but we teach them how to do that. Right? Mm. So they know what they're doing. So persuading parents and increasingly schools in particular and clubs of the importance of having girls. When I was in Auckland yesterday, I went to watch a competition just before I came home, which was all primary schools, and I loved it. These kids were playing in bare feet, which was amazing. Freezing cold, I thought my toes would fall off if it was me. But watching little girls play with the boys, and I went, and I've got to tell you, those little girls, they were tackling as hard as those little boys. It was fun to watch.
Yeah.
But just encouraging schools and parents and the community to understand that girls and women can and should be playing rugby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you have a company, Chikorovsky and Associates. So what's next for you?
So that's my day job.
Yep.
So I run a government relations business and I'm pretty busy at the moment, which is kind of, that's nice, pays the bills.
Yeah.
But for me, when I left Parliament, when I lost the leadership, I had a particularly bad night on the Sunday night. I always took my kids out to dinner on Sunday night. And we were up at one of the local restaurants up at Crow's Nest. And I'm looking at the menu and I've got the menu and I just start to howl uncontrollably. I'm just bawling my eyes out. My two kids were there. They are so embarrassed. Oh, Mum, please stop. So embarrassing. So embarrassed. Please stop. Please stop. And my daughter, who was probably 18 at the time, she looked at me and she said, why are you so upset?
Mm.
And I said, because this is all I've ever wanted to do. This has been my passion. This has been my passion since I was 13. I wanted to be a politician. My 18-year-old daughter looked at me and she said, very sensibly, well, don't you need to find something else you're passionate about?
Yeah.
And it kind of didn't stop me crying, although it did give me some pause for reflection.
Yeah.
So when I left Parliament, I really had no idea what I was going to do, and I kind of ended up doing Chikorovsky & Associates because people started asking me for my help, and that's why I did it. But I did decide I needed to find something that I was going to be passionate about. So that's why I do, you know, the rugby. I love the rugby. That came a little bit later, but I got involved with the Humpty Dumpty Foundation because we provide equipment for seriously ill children and now across the country, over 300 facilities across the country. I was asked to get involved with Adopt Change, which is about, our focus now is getting kids out of foster care into permanent care, because we know that the most stabilising thing for a child, that child's future, is to have a stable family environment, loving family environment. So I'm all about getting kids out of foster care and not having them shoved from one foster. Oh, and let me say, foster care people who do it are amazing, but you know, you wanting a stable family home for a child is the most important thing we can give them. So I choose things like that, and they have become my passion. So I spent a fair bit of time involved in my charities. I was very proud to be appointed to the board of Our Watch by the federal government, which is for the prevention of domestic violence. And, you know, we've had a very challenging year last year. People are probably aware that domestic violence rates were pretty awful last year because everyone was locked in at home. We cope there's a thing called 1-800-RESPECT, which is the domestic violence helpline. It was getting masses of calls between 12 o'clock at night and 3 o'clock in the morning because that was the only time women felt safe to ring. So trying to prevent domestic violence, and domestic violence is preventable. So, you know, putting my time and energy into those organisations is what gets me out of bed. But I've got to say, the thing which I most enjoy now of all the things I do is I've got 4 grandchildren.
Oh, wow.
So I laughed. I took my grandson to his rugby training the other day, and I laughed. I said, it's been a long time since I was standing on the field cheering on a little person. I've been standing on a lot of rugby fields for a whole lot of other people, but not for one that I actually had a personal interest in. So watching my 9-year-old grandson play rugby has been great fun.
Yeah,
I'm trying to persuade my son to let his daughters play, but at the moment he's you know, one of those dads.
One of the dads.
Well, he thinks they should still be doing ballet, and I went, yeah, that'll... that'll last for a while, but I'm telling you, looking at the shapes, I think they could play rugby. One will be a winger, one will be a prop.
So what did start your passion with rugby originally?
Oh, I've always loved rugby. I'm the eldest of all girls. And so in our house, there was none of this, you know, dad took the boys to the footy. No, mum took all of us to the football. My mother was a mad sports person. She loved her rugby. She loved her cricket. And in fact, I laugh, my earliest childhood memory, I worked out not long ago, was rolling down the hill into the white picket fence at Sydney University No. 1 Oval. So I would have been 3. So I've been going to rugby for over 60 years. That's scary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Over 60 years, and have always loved it. But I got involved because Nick Carr-Jones asked me to get involved and to try and step up the women's stuff. But the actual passion for the game, oh no, I've been to a lot of rugby games over a lot of years, and I can declare now, because I'm allowed to, that I'm a Sydney University fan. So,
well, you're one of those lifetime supporters that we need in the game.
Yeah, well, I've been a students fan forever. I used to go and watch when I was at uni, and had friends who played, and been a long time fan. As I said, my parents took me from the time I can remember because my father used to be friends with the people who ran the club way back then. So I would say, 50 years ago.
Yeah. Brilliant.
60 years ago. Bloody hell, 60 years ago.
So, Kerry, I just wanted to finally say thank you. Thank you for your devotion to the women's game in New South Wales. And I truly hope that the female interest and participation continues to grow, and that you get the girls get the required support that they need. But, you know, thank you for your energy towards the women's game. And, it was lovely to talk to you today. And, all the best moving forward. And, we'll hopefully see you on the sidelines.
Oh, look, I'll be there for a very long time. As I said, James is only 9. The girls are 7 and 5, so I reckon I've got at least another 20 years of rugby games to be going to, either watching them or attending with them. I've actually laughed. I've told my grandchildren, that when I get to the stage where I'm too old to walk up and down those stairs on my own, they can come to games with me and help me up and down, because there's no way I'm going to stop going to watch my rugby.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your time today.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Kerry.
Thank you for joining us at Rugby KO. Any comments or insights, please send to katrina@rugbyko.com. For show notes and more about all things rugby, head to our website at www.rugbyko.com. We look forward to your company for our next episode of Rugby KO.